All of us sometime have looked down the wrong end of a telescope or binoculars, haven't we? You can't help but being a child. Sometimes you do it as an adult and hope that no one's watching. But it's one of those things that you just got to do, haven't you? Where you see everything small and distant and remote, and there's a perversity about human nature because the instrument has been designed to enable you to do the exact reverse, but there is more joy in every little boy, and I presume little girl, but I've never been one, little boy's heart at seeing what the binoculars can do the wrong way rather than what they can do the right way. It's part of the human foible that we enter into situations often with wrong assumptions and therefore get the wrong end of the stick. We have the tables turned on us, so just different kinds of expressions used to indicate what is so common amongst us. For we like to be in control of the situations we're in, but quite often we find ourselves out of control. It's like when you watch people. I don't know whether you watch people or not, but I never mind going shopping, provided I don't have to look at the shops. I just like looking at people. People are an endless fascination to me. Shops are ultimately boring. But the trouble with being a people watcher is every now and then somebody sees you watching them. And it's kind of embarrassing then, because you're not supposed to look at people, are you? You're not supposed to stare at people. There's no law against it, but it's somehow not to be a done right thing to do. And when they look at you, looking at them, you get caught out and you kind of look away embarrassedly and then steal another look back at them to see whether they're doing to you what you've just done to them. And sometimes it helps just to smile and say hello on those occasions. I'm learning as I get older not to look at young ladies, so that is more embarrassing still to be caught looking at. Now, the narrative today is a large slab of John, and I'm actually going to push it on even further into chapter 19 and well into it, in the hope that next week we'll do the second half of chapter 19 and all of chapter 20. The narrative is, I guess, in many ways, one of the most famous parts of the Bible. And not only one of the most famous parts of the Bible, it's like the birth narratives we read at Christmas time. It's a beautifully crafted piece of literature, the way you move from one scene to the next, especially through Peter's betrayal, and the dramatic kinds of pauses that you come to, such as the one with which, in fact, you finished for us, the rooster began to crow. It doesn't tell you any more, it doesn't go on and spell out the story, it just leaves you with that awful sinking feeling that Peter had, or that you have with Pilate's great statement, as we come to in a little while, what is truth? Or, here is the man, which I think is better translated in the just for literary style, behold the man, and behold your king, and we have no king but Caesar. There are great statements, it's high drama, and the literature itself carries the dramatic character of it. In the narrative, just to run through it quickly, in verses 1 to 11 we see the arrest in the garden. Judas does his act of betrayal, taking with him soldiers that are both Roman soldiers and Jewish soldiers, which you can't see in the translation, but the Greek words indicate it. And Peter is there, waving his one sword against the Roman Empire and locking off one ear. And we know the name of the man, Malchus. It's one of those kinds of little touches of the history which was totally unnecessary to the story, but just lets you know that the people involved actually were known, and known who it was, and the rest. And it's one of those small details. And then verses 12 to 14 and 19 to 24, you have the trial before Annas. He wasn't the high priest, he was the high priest's father-in-law, but as such, he was the power behind the throne. Caiaphas was the high priest at that time, the one who had already said that it was good for a man to die for the sake of the people. It's an irregular trial at night, not the proper time, not following proper procedures, in front of a judge who actually had no legal power to do it. And verse 24, he sends him on to Caiaphas. The trial before Caiaphas is not recorded for us. It was inside Annas' house that Peter was caught in his betrayal, because Peter's denial is there. Firstly, in verses 15 to 18, when it's explained how he gets in through the disciple who actually was on the inn and who knew who the people were. And then the betrayal, the denial that takes place in verses 25 to 27, where it happens twice on that occasion before the cock crows. There's a great deal of courage in this coward. the courage to follow Jesus, the courage to actually get inside the house, to be warming himself by the fire amongst the enemies. I mean, your heart will be racing at that stage of the game. You can imagine the adrenaline pump he's under. And yet, there is fundamentally cowardice, as he will not stand up for his master. Jesus, though, in the section that I'm about to read on for you, is really caught between the Jews and Pilate. He's the ham in a Jewish sandwich in this place, actually. The Jews can't enter into the court of Pilate because they'll be defiled just at the high point of their most religious ceremony of the year, the day of Pentecost, the day of Passover. And so we have this funny kind of trial at Pilate's house, which is conducted both outside and inside the courtyard. That is, Pilate, who is the ruler, who is the representative of the emperor of Rome, has to run between his prisoner, who he's got inside, and the Jews, who are outside and won't come in and tell him what the thing's about. And so you see him running back and forward between the two. Let's pick it up, verse 28. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now it was early morning, and to avoid ceremonial uncleanness, the Jews did not enter the palace. They wanted to be able to eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and asked, "What are the charges you're bringing against this man?" "If he were not a criminal," they replied, "we would not have handed him over to you." Pilate said, "Take him yourself and judge him by your own law." "But we have no right to execute anyone," the Jews objected. This happened so that the words of Jesus had spoken, indicating the kind of death he was going to die, would be fulfilled. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews, but now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You're right in saying I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate asked. And with this he went out again to the Jews and said, "I find no basis of a charge against him. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in a rebellion. It is marvellously crafted literature in the telling of the story, isn't it? You'd be hard-pressed to tell the story better than it's recorded there. And the character of the man Pilate comes out so quickly, so easily. It's not a photograph, this is a portrait. It really shows you a man, and a man caught in a vice he doesn't want to be in, caught in a place he doesn't want to be involved in, this kind of uprising, this kind of trouble, this kind of difficulty. And there he is running between the two and scoring points as much as he can from the Jews on the way through. He's a good politician. He's a master politician. "I don't actually have to make any decision here, because we've got this rule about releasing one prisoner at the time of the Passover. This bloke's obviously innocent. This is the one I'll let go." You know, so he offers them this man, but they won't hear it. The politician, the expediency doesn't always work. Then Pilate, verse 1 of chapter 19, "Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews,' and they struck him in the face. Once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews, 'Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis of a charge against him.' When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, 'Here is the man.' As soon as the chief priests and the other officials saw him, they shouted out, 'Crucify, crucify!' But Pilate answered, 'You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis of a charge against him.' The Jews insisted, 'We have a law, and according to that law he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God.' When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. 'Where do you come from?' he asked Jesus, but Jesus gave him no answer. 'Do you refuse to speak to me?' Pilate said. 'Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?' Jesus answered, 'You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is the guilty of a greater sin. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of Passover week, about the sixth hour. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus, carrying his own cross. He went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. And here they crucified him, and with him two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be King of the Jews." Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." Powerful literature, isn't it? Powerful literature because it's a powerful moment in history. The whole thing unfolds itself in a series of events. Most of them are initiated by Pilate. What charges in chapter 18, verse 29? They say, well, he's a criminal. So he goes into Jesus and asks the charge in verse 33, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Then Pilate initiates it a second time. "Will I release the king?" They say, "No, give us Barabbas." So Pilate then takes him in, goes back inside and orders that Jesus be mocked as the king, robed, dressed, given a crown. And he brings him out and takes the initiative a third time. "Behold the man." Boy, it must have got up their noses at that point in time. Here he is mocked as a Jew, as a king. They said, well, this man was claimed to be the Son of God. Pilate, scared, goes back inside. Well, where are you from? What's this thing about being a son of God? What is all this about? Are you one of the sons of God? One of the gods come to earth? Jesus' answer only continues to confirm Pilate in his understanding of Jesus' innocence. But the initiative is lost by Pilate then, and so in 19:12 you'll see that the Jews now push further. "You let this man go who claims to be a king, then you're an opponent of Caesar." Pilate's answer, "Behold, your king," does not work. "We have no king but Caesar, and you, Pilate, shouldn't have a king other than Caesar either." "We have no king but Caesar." And so Pilate gives in, and he is crucified. Although he has the last word, doesn't he, by hanging the sign over his head, "The King of the Jews," which he will not try change. What we have here is a series of trials. But in each one of them, people get the wrong end of the binoculars. For you think that what you are seeing here is the trial of Jesus, but in fact, it is the people who keep on being on trial. And so take the garden in chapter 18, verses 1 to 11. Judas was the obvious failure here. Just as been predicted back in chapter 6, at the end of chapter 6, verse 70, we're told that he was a thief in chapter 12, verses 4 to 6, and Jesus knew and predicted that he was going to betray him in chapter 13, verse 26 following. And so he guides the soldiers to where Jesus would be. But the soldiers are none too impressive, for notice how Jesus dominates them all the time, how they fall back from him. He doesn't seek to escape. Rather, he arrests them in mid-flight. There they are coming to him. He says, "Who are you looking for?" He knows who they're looking for. They know who they're looking for. Judas is pointing out he's the one you're looking for, but Jesus takes the initiative on them. "Who are you looking for?" And they say, "Jesus of Nazareth." He says, "Okay, I'm here." That takes them by surprise completely. That's not what people generally do when soldiers come to arrest people. They're usually in flight as fast as can be. They're usually saying, "No, he's not around here. No, he left 10 minutes ago." There's all kinds of options. But this man steps forward and says, "Okay, I'm here. Let the others go free." He stops them. He, in fact, arrests them. He dominates them with this phrase, "Because I am he." Because he knew that's what they were doing, verse 4. And he's concerned that these men be let free, that he only should be taken. That was to fulfill his own words, in verse 9. I have lost none that you have given me. Notice how he uses his own words, quotes his own words, just like he quotes scripture. That my words might be fulfilled, that the scriptures might be fulfilled, are exactly the same thing for Jesus. And notice that he's in charge even when Peter takes the sword, knocks off the ear. Here is now going to be a fight. This is the moment for the fight. And Jesus is like a referee. He steps in the middle and says, put that away, to Peter. He says, look, shall I not drink, verse 11, the cup the Father has given me? No. Here I am, forget about them. And they don't arrest Peter. They just let Jesus take control of the whole arrest scene. It's unlike any arrest you see on TV. The arrested man arrests his arresters as they try to arrest him. It is almost the exact opposite of what you saw O.J. Simpson trying to do. Peter's trial is so famous before us, isn't it? In verse 37, you see the brave, chapter 13, verse 37, we read the brave disciple. He says, Lord, why can't I follow you? I'll lay down my life for you. And he tries to follow. He is the one who pulls the sword. He is the one in verse 15 of chapter 18 who follows into the courtyard, into warming himself by the fire. But he doesn't understand. He doesn't understand Jesus in verse 11, that Jesus has to go to his Father, that Jesus has to drink the cup of the wrath of the Lord. And he doesn't understand himself in verse 17 and verse 25, for he uses expediency to gain entry, not realizing that you cannot win the truth by lies. See the little question that's asked there as he goes in. Where is it? Verse 17. You are not one of his disciples, are you? The girl at the door asked Peter. And he replied, I am not. In Greek, unlike in English, you can indicate whether the answer you're expecting is yes or no by a particular word that you use. If you use ou, it expects yes. If you use me, it expects no. And so in Greek, you always know which answer is expected by the questioner. In English, we do that by tone of voice. Sometimes by putting in not in the right part of the sentence, but it's very hard to convey in English. But in this question, she's expecting the answer no. Can I come in? Well, you're not one of the disciples, are you? Well, of course you can go in. And Peter says, no, I'm not one of the disciples, and comes in. And he's giving the answer she is expecting. That is the way in. And it's also the second time. It's the same way. You're not one of his disciples, are you? In verse 25. And he says, no, I'm not. But the third time, one of the high priests, verse 26, a relative of the man whose Peter's ear had cut off, he said, hang on, didn't I see you? You are one of them. This is not the expecting no, this is the expecting yes. But he's already conceded the point twice before, to get in, to stay in. And at that point, he continues in his denial. Verse 27, the rooster crows. And chapter 13, verse 38, the word of Jesus is fulfilled. Before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times. He thought he was watching the trial of Jesus, but he himself was the one on trial. And he failed dismally. He was not the only one on trial. The Jews were also on trial that night. I mean, in one sense, it was not a real trial that they operated with Jesus. It was a phony. It was at night when there shouldn't have been a trial. There was no formal charges brought. There were no witnesses brought. Annas was not actually the high priest that year. In one sense, it was no real trial. It was so irregular that some modern, especially Jewish apologists, have claimed that the whole thing is unhistorical. Because no first century Jew would conduct a trial like this. It broke so many of the Jewish rules of how to conduct a trial. But that's the point. It was irregular. It was a they wouldn't have called it this in those days, but it was a kangaroo court. That's the whole point of the thing. It was a lynch mob, that they had no charge to bring against Jesus. That was right. Annas was not really in power. They did it at night because they needed to get to the Roman court early. Roman officials started their day at dawn and tended to knock off around about lunchtime. The starting at dawn doesn't sound so crash hot, but the knock off at lunchtime sounds very, very appealing as a form of government and control. So if they wanted to get to see the Roman official the next day, they had to be there early in the morning. Therefore, they had to work out what to do that night. It was also at night because they wanted the death before Passover. I mean, they were running into their holy days when they couldn't deal with this kind of matter. They only had tomorrow in which to deal with it, and they couldn't hang on to the matter. And they didn't certainly want the crowds who supported Jesus to be rising up. I mean, if you're going to do a lynching, do it quickly. And they wanted it at night because, as the Gospel of John keeps telling us, darkness is the symbol of evil. It's when people do evil deeds, when it's hidden. But their failure is bigger than the phony trial. Notice the hypocrisy of 1828. They're so concerned about their ceremonial cleanliness while they're involved in lynching the innocent. They're very concerned to eat the Passover while they are sacrificing the Passover lamb, the Lord Jesus himself. It is so often the way with we who are religious, and therefore we who are Christianly religious need to be particularly wary of it, that we can be more concerned with the externals than the truth and the internal. We can be more concerned that we are ceremonially pure than pay attention to the murder in our hearts. Throughout this trial, Pilate humiliates the Jews. He aims to, and he succeeds. Verse 31 of 18, why don't you do it yourselves? It's a put down because they can't do it themselves. If they did do it themselves, they'd do it by stoning. That's what the Jewish law required. That's what, if you remember, they did to Stephen. They could do it if they could prove that he was attacking the temple. Even the Romans would allow the Jews to do it under that grounds, but they couldn't prove that he was attacking the temple. So they couldn't do it. So they had to acknowledge that Rome was in control, and that's what he does in verse 31. He rubs his nose in it. He rubs their noses in it. He says, you do it. They say, oh no, we need you, Pilate. We need you. Yes, well, you do need me, don't you? Thank you for acknowledging this. But the whole thing was for a different reason altogether, that neither he nor they realized verse 32. It had to be this way, for Jesus had prophesied that he was going to be lifted up. His crucifixion had been predicted 3 or 4 times in this gospel. That's what he prophesied. That's what had to be fulfilled. His word, like the scriptures, has to be fulfilled. And so he makes fun of him, verse 39. What shall I do? Will I release for you the King of the Jews? He loves calling them the King of the Jews. He loves it. You see, I now have your king in my prison. Where does that put you? And here is your king. Let me show you your king. A beaten up, battered carpenter wandering Galilean. This is your king. It's the kind of king you Jews are deserving, really. He is at my disposal, and he is someone who looks anything but a king, and you don't even want him. What shall I do with your king, the King of the Jews? Behold, here is your king. Do you really want me to crucify your king? This is the King of the Jews. No, I'm not going to say he claimed to be the King of the Jews. He is the King of the Jews. What I have written, I have written. The Jews are humiliated throughout the whole process. And they demonstrate their immorality throughout the process. See, they have no charges to bring against him in verse 30. So they just have chapter 18. So they say, well, look, we wouldn't have bought him if he wasn't guilty. Which really is hardly a charge, is it? But it's the way. And they're willing to accept Barabbas, a man who in fact was guilty, rather than Jesus, against whom they had no charge. And
chapter 19, verse 7, the Jews insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law he must die because he claimed to be the Son of God." How can you be guilty of speaking the truth? If he is the Son of God, then he is the Son of God. Where is the guilt in that? Well, the only law the Jew has which says that against that law he must die is the law of blasphemy. But it's no blasphemy to call God your father if God is your father. In fact, it would be a blasphemy to say that he wasn't. There was no charge here. And then they appeal to Roman morality. That is to expediency, verse 12 of 19. "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." It's a political maneuver at this point, isn't it? Whose friendship is yours? Are you really going to? They are manipulating him into bringing the death penalty. And they ultimately are caught in that manipulation. For once you move into such expediency, look where they wind up in verse 15. "Take him away, take him away, crucify him. Shall I crucify your king? We have no king but Caesar." The chief priest answered. No king but Caesar. This was the people who were looking forward to the coming of the Messiah. This is the people who were looking forward to the King of Kings who was going to rule the universe. And they are now denying the Messiah. "We have no king." And more, this is the people who had God as their king. For throughout the Old Testament, God is the King of Israel. And they are saying, "We have no king but Caesar." And they're right. For God is not their king. They have denied him already. "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." Is a truth and a lie at the same moment, isn't it? It's a truth. To claim God as king means you will not be a friend of Caesar. And yet it's a lie, isn't it? For God is the King of Kings and the King of Caesar. Their expediency traps them into denying their own faith. And throughout it, it looks as if in this Jewish trial that they are in charge, but Jesus is in charge. It looks as if Jesus has fallen into their hands, but it showed their impotence and their immorality. For it winds up declaring Jesus' own message. The longer the trial goes, the more he is declared to be what he hasn't been declared for the whole 18 chapters of the Gospel up until this stage, that is, the King of the Jews. But over and over again, peppered through these chapters, are the phrase, "the King of the Jews, the King of the Jews, the King of the Jews." That's what he was ultimately condemned as, the King of the Jews. That was his crime, to be the King of the Jews. That's what he was killed as, the King of the Jews. The truth comes. It all comes in irony. But it shows Jesus in control. And so, verse 32 of chapter 18, he determined what kind of death he would have. And they play into his hands. Now at this point, I want to just depart for a very brief moment, if I can, from the text, to say a word about anti-Semitism. And 20th century anti-Semitism at that point. The hatred of the Jews down the centuries, and in this century in particular, and in our country even to this moment, is a despicable, unjustified and degenerate characteristic of racists and sinners. It has absolutely no place in Christian thinking or living or actions, and it must always be exposed as ungodly. We have no grounds ever to hate the Jews as a group of people, as a race or as a community, or to act in any way that would be prejudicial to their advantage and their life in society. The Jews have been judged by groups of people down the years as Christ slayers. That misunderstands history and it misunderstands the cross of Christ very seriously. However, in our guilt over the Holocaust, we mustn't deny the truth. it did happen that the opponents of Jesus were the Jews, the Jerusalem Judean establishment Jews of the first century. It happened that way as God's plan. It happened that way according to Jesus' expectation. It happened that way as a historical fact. That is the group of people who demanded his execution. We mustn't let our guilt over the Holocaust deny the reality. That's what happened. But we also mustn't conclude from that that all Jews, now and then, are guilty of the crime. As if those who hundreds of years later are still Jewish are somehow guilty for the first century. Nor that all Jews, as a result of this, are cursed by God. Nor that we Gentiles would not do the same thing or did not do the same thing. For Pilate is a Gentile, and he is as guilty. He is there doing it too, and the soldiers, they are knocking him around. We Gentiles are there doing it. And that we Gentiles are not equally to blame. All that is completely... It's drawing the wrong conclusions from the fact. The fact is the Jews called for the death of Jesus. But the fact, the truth that the gospel is on about is the fact that it was my sins that caused the death of Jesus. Mine and yours and every human being. That we are the ones who killed the Christ. And to blame the Jews as the Christ slayers and therefore to give to them some kind of second-class citizenship is to draw completely the wrong conclusion from what is being said here. And it's a piece of just old-fashioned degenerate racism. And we must not allow it to take place, even as we read John's account and see that the Jews did it. And remember that John, who wrote this account, was himself a Jew. That's why this cannot be anti-Semitism. That's not what it is. And it's wrong to read it that way. But let's turn to Pilate, who plays such a significant part in it. For Pilate really is on trial throughout it, isn't it? He looks like the judge sitting in the judgment, but he really was on trial and he failed dreadfully, for he was guilty. I mean, he enjoyed putting down the Jews and showing their impotence and their need of him, but he is caught at their disposal. He winds up doing their work for them. He is caught running back and forth at the Jewish behest. He's really not in control of the Jews. He's a servant, actually under their control, and they keep forcing him to take action when he clearly doesn't want to take action. He doesn't want to do this. He wants to let Jesus go. He recognizes that Jesus is innocent, that there is no charge against him. But yet, he has to keep on doing it because they keep on raising the stakes. He calls himself the Son of God. You can't let him go and be a friend of Caesar. They keep on pushing him. And he gives the great politician's plea of pragmatism. Verse 38, well, what is truth? Our politicians are exactly the same, friends. They tell lies. But of recent times, have you noticed that they are now saying that you cannot govern the country without telling lies? And furthermore, they're saying that it is all right to tell lies to the populace and to the people, especially around election time. That's all right. You just mustn't tell lies in the House. And in the House, the Parliament, you always make sure that you cover every sentence with a little escape clause so that no one ever says anything, let alone lies. It's because they place power and utility and effectiveness and peace and prosperity as being all more important than truth. Whereas God is God of truth. Pilate is the model of politicians today. He is their philosophical forefather. He's not so much a man who is untruthful as a man who is atruthful, a completely new English word created just for today's campus Bible study. He is without truth. He's not telling lies, he's saying there is no truth, atruthful. The more our society moves from virtues to values, it moves to relativism and therefore makes values irrelevant. It's a funny thing, isn't it? There used to be virtues like telling the truth. There are now values like, well, truth is more important to this person than to that person. And once you move to those values, then everybody's values are their own values, and therefore your values become irrelevant. See, a recent church member of ours was denied promotion because he would not condone corruption, and the argument used was he was cross-culturally insensitive, for he refused to allow corruption in third world countries in doing international trade deals with them. And they said, well, look, you've got to understand the other culture. Other cultures all involve corruption. You've got to bribe to get the business. He said, I don't bribe because I don't believe in corruption. Throughout the world, corruption is destroying third world countries. But in this country, we want to do business with the corrupt so that we can make our money. He stood for truth and was denied promotion. Pilate met a real king. And Jesus, notice, called him to answer. Where'd you hear about that? Are you a Jew or something? I'm not a Jew. What do you mean? Did you think that up all yourself, that I'm the king of the Jews? Poor old Pilate, what kind of prisoner had he met? Never one like this before. Jesus says, I'm a king, but not of this world. I've come to testify to the truth. Pilate knows this man's innocent. Says it over again, 1838, 19 verse 4, 19 verse 12. Pilate comes to him and says, look, I can release you, or I can execute you. Why don't you answer me? Why don't you give me the information? Jesus says, you couldn't do anything except the fact has been given to you. He says, the ones who are handing me over, they're the ones that are guilty. But Pilate, knowing he's innocent, still has him crucified. Knowing he's innocent, still has him thrashed. Knowing he is the king, won't back down from the declaration. Throughout the 1.5 chapters, Jesus is on trial. But yet is he? For he is in control in all of the events. And his kingdom is now at last proclaimed, a worldly kingdom. It is not. For worldly kingdoms are of power and of militarism. They pretend to use truth and logic and argument and justice, but it's all about power. Sadly, Christians keep forgetting this. That's why we went on things like the Crusades. That's why churches use so much money and are concerned for political parties. The kingdom of God does not go forth by the powers of this world. Jesus' kingdom is of the truth. He testified to the truth. We beheld his glory full of truth. The devil, he says, is the father of all lies who wishes to murder. But God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. And I am the way, the truth, and the life, who sends the Spirit of truth to convict the world and to guide his disciples. And those, verse 37 of chapter 18, those on the side of truth listened to me. The world that we live in today of deconstructionist spin doctors, the world of postmodernists, are the world of what happens when you deny God. There is no God, or as Nietzsche puts it better, God is dead. And Nietzsche also says, truth is fiction. That is the character. You get rid of God, you get rid of absolutes, you get rid of absolutes, you get rid of truth. You get rid of truth, you wind up with the politicians that we've got. Truth does not matter. Expediency is all. It's as old as Pontius Pilate. Jesus speaks the truth, and those who know the truth listen to him. Of course, in the end, this is our trial, isn't it? As we read it, we think we have Jesus on trial and we can evaluate Jesus, but in the end, it doesn't matter what we evaluate Jesus, it matters what Jesus evaluates us. For Jesus keeps turning the tables on us as well. You see, we're there thinking we can pass judgment on Judas. Wasn't he a rotten rat, think, betraying for money? Peter, wasn't he a wimp, coward? Caiaphas and Annas, weren't they evil in what they were trying to do? Pilate, wasn't he a weakling? Wasn't he wet? You can't make any of those judgments without judging yourself, can you? The claims of Jesus go beyond the first century. He's talking about a kingdom of heaven. He's talking about truth itself. And his claims confront us. See, we don't mind watching the politicians squirm, but verse 37 calls upon us as to where we stand with regard to truth and with regard to Jesus. For here amongst us, I guess there may well be an opponent of Jesus.
who would gladly have him crucified, there are many of us who are weaklings, want to follow the truth, but not at the cost, not at being unpopular, not for any inconvenience. We know he is true, but the pragmatism of family and friends and career will not allow us to live by the truth. We're not going to let the truth get in our way. But Jesus says, everyone on the side of truth listens to me. He's not on trial. We're on trial, whether we'll listen to him or not.